The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to The Phantom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zacharin, the features editor at Sci-Fi, and I'm flying solo on this sans co-host, Emily Gaudette, who is my regular co-host. She's on vacation. Caitlin Bush, who is my associate features editor and a recent guest co-host. She's on vacation in Myrtle Beach, which like I thought was a place that only existed in commercials and 90s sitcoms. But she's like 24, so she's from the South or Midwest. So that's what they go. I'm sure she'll have fun, so good for Caitlin. And then personally, my girlfriend is also away for the next 4 days on a bit of a girls' trip in Florida. So I'm just like dangerously close to becoming unmoored in some kind of like uncivilized like beast more than I already am. Luckily, I have a dream guest for me in the studio today. And so for the next hour, however long he wants to stay here and give me his time, I am going to keep my shit together as best I can. David Mandel is absolutely living his and honestly my best life. He's a showrunner on Veep after decades as a writer and producer on shows like SNL, Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is like, as I'm saying it, like a Mount Rushmore of comedy, both in general and me personally as like a Jewish kid from New Jersey. So he's also, but he's here also to talk, mostly to talk about, he's a renowned collector of nerd stuff. He's got a set, like a, I read in the New York Times article a couple of years ago, an entire second home apartment filled with original comics art and Ewok heads. Not just those two.
Head.
Yeah, head. Okay, it's one. That'd be really... He's a creepy sailor filled with fuzzy heads. But yeah, it's and you've written a book about Ralph McQuarrie. So David, thank you for being here. I know you're in New York for
My pleasure. I mean, I'm sorry to miss Caitlin and whatever her name is, but yeah
it's unimportant.
Fine.
No. I'm kind of happy they're gone, so I get you all to myself. So I didn't plan it out that way, but it worked out. You worked at this building for a lot of years.
Yeah, actually, this was really my first. I mean, I guess my first real job. I worked at Saturday Night Live here for 3 years from. 92 to 95, sort of the end of Dana Carvey and those guys, and then sort of the rise of Sandler, Farley, Spade, and those guys. And then I left in 95 to go to LA, and then I left, and then the next cast, which was like Will Ferrell and Molly and all those people, kind of Sherry O'Terry, kind of came in. So I was here for 3 years every day. Yeah,
that is.
It was actually very weird this morning because I'm staying here in the city with my parents, which is where I was first living when I started Saturday Night Live. And then I basically came here to this building, much as I would have done on a Friday, basically. This was like a very typical Friday.
Yes, that is
exactly.
Really funny.
Yeah, it was kind of weird.
That is, you know, writing 92 to 95, that you shaped my childhood more than even like, because I used to get the, I mean, I was alive then. I was conscious. I was watching TV. I was born in 1986. But I would get those tapes of SNL, the compilations from Costco.
Cool.
Like every weekend, I would get a new one.
That's funny.
From years and actors. So thank you for that.
I just threw out a giant box of videotapes of old Saturday Night Live, like that I bought of like the 70s and like, you know, and some best ofs of the 80s. And it was just like, what am I doing with these things? You know, that's it's all available elsewhere. Yeah, but there's some limits even to my collecting.
Well, it's funny that everyone thinks their the one SNL cast they grew up watching is like the best.
The best ever.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like they're going to be, and I love the current cast. I think there's a lot of really talented people.
And I think, I can tell you this from when I worked there, I think when you're working there, you actually forget sometimes that like you think you're talking to like, I don't know, the 40-year-old editor. I mean, especially if you're writing like a political sketch, like you think it's, you're directing it to like the 40-year-old like editor of the New York Times, and most likely it's just an 8-year-old in New Jersey watching it. Yeah.
That's, I mean, I look back on the stuff I love and I'm like, that probably wasn't the smartest of the sketches.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I understood what Dana Carvey was doing with, you know, George H.W. Bush and all that.
You know, when I was a kid, and obviously I watched SNL too, it was sort of like, you know, you learn things. Like, I remember learning about movies from Mad Magazine, movies I'd never seen. And I think SNL's sort of the same thing. It's like, it may be your first exposure to politics or things like that in a great way.
Yeah. I think a lot of people's impression of George W. Bush is Will Ferrell.
He's basically Will Ferrell, yeah, exactly. And by the way, and his father's was Dana Carvey.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
oh yeah, that's entirely my impression of George. All I think of is like, Naga don't do it.
Right.
You know, that's all I think of. Anyways, you also, growing up, were a huge geek for geek stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this other places too. I was born in 1970, so I was 7 years old when Star Wars came out. And so every part of it was momentous. I mean, seeing the movie in the theater, which I think we sat through twice the first time with my dad, the comic books coming out, the Star Wars comics. I mean, I have distinct memories of reading the big old treasury size mm-hmm. comic books of the adaptation. Then when the adaptation kept going and it was six individual issues, and then all of a sudden there was issue 7 and it was Han and Chewie in a new adventure. And it was sort of like, oh my God. And then also the action figures, which at the time, you know, I definitely had a lot of Migos. I was playing with the old Mego toys mm-hmm. and stuff. And then all of a sudden there were these Star Wars figures that, because they were so much smaller, oh my God, I have the Millennium Falcon. I have right. the land speeder, these, like, you know, what seemed like these giant ships, but all of a sudden you could play with them. And it was just incredible. And those are the things that, you know, to this day, I mean, it's the stuff I collect. Honestly, what we just talked, everything I just said is a key part of my collection
right.
to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, you have this collection in your, I think it was like your bachelor pad.
Yeah, it was basically my home. I mean, it was actually my, you know, sort of New York style LA condo. Mm-hmm. And then I got married and we actually lived there for a year. Although in my wife's defense, basically 24 hours, it was about 3 weeks into our marriage, we came back from the honeymoon and we sort of lived it one night in my condo. And basically she was like, we got to get out of here. So, but we lived there for almost a year. And then, you know, kids and stuff, we moved yeah. out. And I just kind of kept the condo and just kind of left everything. And slowly over the years, I've sort of moved out like furniture and beds and things. Mm-hmm. And it's just really about the collection. Yeah.
My girlfriend lives with me in my studio apartment now. She moved in, and there is not a lot of room for my Godzilla collection, which is now on my desk here at 30 Rock. Not a lot of room, both physically and just in her life.
Right, mentally, yeah. mentally. Yeah, that's the hard part, is the mental.
Well, so, I mean, I know you got started, and I want to go back to your childhood
please.
In a minute, but you got started collecting, I read, during the Seinfeld years when you were in LA.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny, you know, and again, the tie-in in a funny way between work and, you know, Seinfeld, obviously dream job, dream show and all that kind of stuff, but also, it sounds silly to say, but a lot of work. And especially as it kept going, we used to do these long, like, you know, we would work like 53 days in a row and then take a Sunday. And then we do 47 days and watch the Super Bowl. And then, you know, another 63 days. And we loved it. And we had our nights. It wasn't like we were there 24 right. hours, but it was every day. And I had discovered comic art, which for me was a real discovery, because when I was a younger kid, I definitely was a collector. I had some baseball cards and I had some comic books. And I was a huge X-Men fan. X-Men for me was the big, you know, especially Chris Claremont X-Men. Chris Claremont, first Cochran, then John Byrne, then Cochran again, but then into the other artists. And so that for me was the biggie. And I can remember, you know, I collected comics a little bit. I certainly was buying comics and like sealing them up because I thought, you know, this Flash number one with Wally West, was going to be, you know, worth billions of dollars.
You're smart.
Well, I don't know. The stuff I was collecting about a couple of years ago, I undid my New York storage. I had like a 40 box of comics in storage here in New York City. And I schlepped them all. I got them shipped out to LA and I had a sort of a buddy go through them all. And it was much worse than I was expecting. Unless like we become like Waterworld, where paper is worth like a lot, it was not so good.
My comics from the 90s, I used to like put them in, you know, board of
bags. Of course, yeah.
And like those aren't worth anything because they made so many of them.
But you know, it was true even for the 80s stuff too. Yeah. It just, I mean, there's books that were, you know, I got some money, but like certainly not.
Right.
Yes. And again, that's not really why I was doing it, but you know, you have the vision that my friend was going to look through it and go, oh my God, you have Team America number one, you know, and that didn't quite happen. But what I was going to say was, I was always reading the comic books, and X-Men was a biggie for me, but as a comic book collector, I definitely sort of never had enough money in my wallet in the sense of like Giant Size X-Men 1 was a real, obviously, you know, key book, touchstone book, the birth of the new X-Men team, Wolverine joins the team, all that kind of stuff. And it was one of those books, I always joke that like if I had $20 in my wallet, it was $30. If I had 30, it was 40. If I had 40, it was 60. You know, it was one of those things. And when I finally got out to Los Angeles, I was able to first attend my first San Diego Comic-Con. And so I went the first, like, you know, whatever it was, July of working for Seinfeld. And I went down like on a Saturday and went to the show. The first thing I was able to do now that I actually had some, you know, money in my pocket was I bought Giant Size X-Men 1 and I filled in my entire X-Men run that I wanted. It felt really, really good. But I was soon at that show exposed to my first piece of comic art and it really appealed to me. This is the hand-drawn original pen and ink stuff. And it appealed to me, I guess, a little bit as a frustrated artist. I'm a terrible artist. I sort of draw like a four-year-old, basically. still, to this day. It was like I was really good at 4 years old and then never got better.
I peaked at like seventh grade drawing Spider-Man. And then like the whole like I had to learn perspective and it just...
Perspective in any of my work. So, you know, it was one of those things where like, you know, those who can't collect. So I loved like seeing these pages. And then also, as you sort of dug into them, you know, there'd be like these interesting notes and sample dialogue and changes and all this kind of stuff and notes to the editor, notes from the editor. And I was just fascinated by it. Plus, I guess that inner collector in me, this notion that like Giant Size X-Men 1, the comic book, I have a copy. You have a copy. The engineer has 3 copies. That guy has 11 copies, you know, and even if you have a great copy, that guy's got 2 great copies. But if you have an actual page from Giant Size X-Men 1 or the cover to Giant Size X-Men 1, which I was lucky enough to acquire down the line, that's it. I own the cover to Giant Size X-Men 1. And there is that collector ego, that collector whatever of I have it. No one else can have it or has one like it.
Right.
And there's something also very pleasing to that. But, you know, but it's also, you know, I mean, there's that. And then it's that combo of the nostalgia. That book was so important to me as a kid. And then to own the cover, you know, so much of my early art purchases were really grabbing original art or covers to things that meant something to me. And that's, you know, and that, I mean, that's what all collecting is nostalgia. I mean, I'm sure you collect Godzilla because you were exposed to it at the right age. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, again, like, I guess I got a lot of weird VHS because I would get, I get them at like Suncoast or something. All the Godzilla's like translated. I had no idea they were like deep and political, you know, but now I do.
Right.
I
no, it's like, oh, this is about nuclear power. No, I don't care. It's just about, you know.
Right. Yeah. Like a little boy running around. Yeah. Godzilla Returns. I had, you know, or Godzilla's Revenge. I had no idea. So, it, I mean, a lot of books, a lot of art was thrown away back in the day.
Yes.
So but by the 70s and 80s, they started figuring it out.
But more than you thought was saved.
Okay.
And then at some point or another, and, you know, there's a lot of controversy, I guess, about some of it, which is for a long time, the artists themselves didn't get the art back. That was a big controversy. So early on, things were thrown out. But at the same time, even though things were supposed to be thrown out, there were a lot of, like, especially those guys who were like the first group of organized collectors who then went on to like intern and work.
Right.
So guys like, I think like Marv Wolfman and like Len Wein who were fans, but then ended up in like internships and low level jobs at the different companies. You know, you hear stories of them, like they were told to like get rid of and destroy like old, like, you know, Justice Society stuff from like, I don't know, I guess like the 40s. And so they did cut them up, but they would cut them along the border, so like one page would then become like 3 rows of panels, and then they would be very neatly put in the garbage downstairs so that somebody could come and remove them from the garbage very easily. And obviously you always had people kind of taking stuff. And then also beyond that, you know, like in the 60s, I believe what's his name, one of the editors would send, if you wrote a letter, if you wrote a letter into like the Flash Comics, Julie Schwartz, who was the longtime editor at DC Comics, if your letter was published, I think you got sent sometimes either a complete story of Flash or the cover.
Oh.
So there, those are out. So, you know, there's so much out there. Mm-hmm. But at some point or another, I believe the companies had sort of these warehouses and eventually art was returned to the artists. And while they probably didn't get everything back they were supposed to, they obviously got a lot. And then obviously since then, the artists themselves own their art. And I think a lot of, really great comic book artists, sort of sustain their careers by both obviously working, but also having a market for their art.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine, like, especially now, like, collectors are rabid.
Right. Especially key guys. Although right now, of course, the shame of it is, I'm sure it helps their work. There's so much computer and digital stuff that, for me, my favorite pages are, usually penciled and inked, and then, the letters, the word balloons on them. Because I have pages where the reason I have the page is because that page from a story has like a line of dialogue I always remembered. And therefore, having the word balloon on it, is as much, I'm collecting the page. I'm not just collecting the artist or the inker or whatever. I'm really collecting this moment from this story. So it's as much about the writer and everything else that was going on. Nowadays, if you're lucky, you get a pencil and inked page with no letter balloons. Sometimes it's just pencil because they're digitally inking. And then there are just guys that, just use computers for everything and there is no art. And so, you can love someone and go, hey, can I get something from that? And there's just nothing. There's a book right now. I don't know. Do you read comics or not? Oh, are you reading Mr. Miracle by?
I haven't yet.
Oh, read Mr. Okay. Miracle. It's Tom King is the writer, and the artist is Mitch. I think it's pronounced Gerards. If I'm screwing that up, I apologize.
Okay.
But I believe he's all digital. So I love this book. I would buy a page in a second. Unbuyable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's and like, yeah, I guess they don't print them out if there's no reason to do
no,
that.
No, no. Yeah. I mean, and even
and
if they
still wouldn't be the same.
Right. And that's exactly it. Even if it was a one of one printout, it's not, there's a tactileness to the art collecting.
Yeah.
So
what kind of pages were, like, you talked about these moments you really care about, lines of dialogue. Which ones did you really seek out that were most important to you?
Different ones. For example, when I was in third grade, I had my appendix out in the Mount Sinai Hospital. And I remember reading the X-Men annual where it's four or five X-Men annual where Nightcrawler is killed and then the X-Men have to travel into Dante's Inferno to save him. And so I have a couple of pages from it, but I was able to get the cover a couple of years ago.
Right.
And, I remember reading that comic over and over and over in the hospital while I was having my appendix out. And so, you can't put a price on that. Do you know what I mean? It's just one of those, those things. Yeah.
So back then,
yeah.
I mean, this is 95 or so, you went to Comic-Con. What was the market like? Were they expensive?
Well, that was the beauty of it, too, which was having, I guess, missed the boat, or at least at the time, it seemed like I missed the boat on comic books, although I guess the truth be told, if I had bought, key books, even in 90, whatever, they went up. Everything goes up. But you could do a lot of damage. I could go down to a Comic-Con in the sort of mid-90s and, spend, and I don't want to make this sound like this is an insignificant amount of an insignificant number, but for me at the time, in 95, a single guy working all the time at Seinfeld, being, very well paid for somebody my age, and also, renting an apartment, leasing a car, and, that was it. And they were, and they were paying for most of my meals because we were at work all the time. It's like I had very little actual expenses.
Yes.
I could spend like $5,000 at a Comic-Con and come back with a thick multi-inch pile of comic art, like a pile of art where I would almost need to like have a friend get me another like portfolio to and every night, and again, it was a different time. Every night you'd sit down and like, let's look through the 30 pieces I picked up today and the five pieces or the 10 pieces you picked up and all that kind of stuff. And it was just, it was very reasonably priced. It was available. It was pre-eBay. It was pre a lot of like the speculation that has come into it all. And, like anything else, it's changed. Now obviously, huge numbers and these big, public comic art auctions and stuff. And it's not as fun. And, you know, on the one hand, people always go like, well, your stuff is worth more. It's not why I bought it. I bought it because I was, you know, I was a kid in the hospital reading X-Men. That's why I bought that page or that cover. And so the fact that that cover is now maybe, you know, whatever, quadrupled in price is actually somewhat uninteresting to me.
Okay. It'll be,
it's great for, I guess, my heirs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like if my kids want to like sell it all when I'm gone, great. And I'm happy about that. But the fact that I can't buy as much as I want to buy is not as fun. There's no other way of saying it. Yeah.
So what? So when you got it, and you brought it, you bring it back to your condo. What did you do with it? Did you frame it? Did you just store it?
This one isn't framed. There's a lot of stuff is framed, but obviously wall space is you know sort of troublesome just in general.
Sure.
And I've been actually I'm in the middle right now of doing a whole sort of rearranging where I will simply say for a long time the stuff was sort of framed like, you know, here's a piece on the center of the wall and sort of nicely spaced. And now I'm sort of jamming everything together to try and get more stuff on the wall. But, you know, it's in a piece of Mylar, so it's protected. Then the Mylar goes into this wonderful sort of Itoya folder that is sort of X-Men themed that allows me to sort of like, almost like a book, open it up. And that way I can kind of see the cover and then the couple of pages that I have from the book sort of in page order. So obviously it's not like reading the comic itself, but I can sort of, you know, fetishly stare at it.
Do you do that a lot? Do you look through all?
I definitely do. I mean, you know, or certainly, you know, if something I haven't looked at in a while, I'm aware that I haven't looked at it and I'll sort of pull it out. And, you know, and I'm a collector, so I'm constantly making lists. I'm constantly sort of, you know, reevaluating and thinking to myself, like, excuse me, these are my best 10 X-Men pieces or, you know, what's my order? And then because things cost what they cost these days, and I think most collectors would probably say the same thing. I think museums talk about this as well. You'd sort of, as they say, you de-ascensionize or, you know, where basically, you know, I'll go through and I'll go, these are my 10 best pieces, but I have 14 of them. So maybe if I sell these three or four, that allows me to buy that new piece I'm seeing. And so very often I'll buy something at one of the big auction houses, you know, for a price that I don't always love, but I, you know, and I don't necessarily get the piece immediately, but I can say to them, hey, I'm sending you four pieces for your next auction.
Mm.
And then usually that more than takes care of it. And so in a perfect world, eventually you know, for me at least, I feel like I'm getting more and more of the pieces I want. And in some ways, maybe even not, believe me, no one would look at my collection and think it's thin, but thinning it out a little bit so that, you know, again, I have my 10 favorite X-Men pieces instead of my 12, but now I have my 10 favorite X-Men pieces. I just did this recently, actually, oddly enough, talking about Star Wars before, the cover to Star Wars 9. So it was the 9th issue of Star Wars, but in that world, it's the 7, 8, and 9 are like these Han Solo adventures, wonderful stories. You know, written by, I think they were written by Roy Thomas, and they were sort of these continuing adventures, and it was kind of a Magnificent Seven kind of story where Han and Chewie team up with this ragtag group of, you know, to help like a little like space alien village. It's a really good story, but even if it's not a really good story, I remember it.
Sure.
And like I said, for me, it was like, oh my God, there's Star Wars continuing. So to find the Star Wars 9 cover, which showed up in an auction, I was just thrilled, shocked and thrilled. And so I bought it and it went for, you know, way more than I ever thought. I mean, again, I don't over like really want to make it about the prices,
sure.
but it just
it
did.
Matters,
it just did. It went for so much more. And the second I bought it, I was like, oh God. But I was like, you know what? Here comes, I was like, you know, it's an auction house. I've known these people a while. They know me. You know, they hold on to the piece and I go, here, I'm sending you the stuff for the next auction. Next auction rolls around. I sold some stuff that honestly, even at this point, even though it was only about a month ago, I'm not even sure I could name everything I sold. Like it was just stuff that didn't mean as much to me. All gone, all sold. I paid for the cover and then some. And I have that cover now in my collection, and I'll never remember those lesser pieces that I don't even care about.
You're trying to make a more perfect collection.
I guess so. Yeah, exactly. And it is, you know, and it is the luck of having a large enough collection that I can sell off these things that keep me competitive now that even for me, I think the prices are madness.
Yeah.
Even though maybe I'm partially responsible for those prices.
Well, I mean, it's like anything, like real estate, you know, it's the same thing. Yeah.
No, exactly.
When you're part of a market. You know, you mentioned like you loved Star Wars 9 and you loved the story they had. And you're like, I loved it as a kid. I don't know how great it holds up.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot with stuff I love. And I think that's, I think a problem people now have when they go back and everything's getting rebooted and they're adults. I'm like, oh, maybe this thing isn't great.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, go ahead.
Oh, no. When you go and read these old comics, like you love them because you loved them as a kid, but how do they hold up?
Some hold up, some don't. I mean, that's the honest answer. Yeah. You know, I can remember a couple of years ago, they released, or I should say re-released on DVD for the first time or whatever it was, the old Buck Rogers show with Gil Gerard and whatever. And I could not have ordered that thing quicker because, I mean, oh my God, Buck Rogers and, you know, Twicky the robot and all that stuff. And, oh my God, it was awful. I mean, I just couldn't even believe how awful it was. It's still a fond memory, but like there was no going back to it. Which is obviously a very different feeling that I have about, you know, like obviously for me, I think, you know, Star Wars, just as a movie, I don't think I'm saying anything too controversial here, holds up.
I think we can accept that.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So obviously, you know, things do, things don't. When I go back and I read, you know, some of the great, like I said, that great X-Men run by Claremont, it holds up. When you go back and read the great Frank Miller Daredevil run, it holds up. When you go back and read, you know, Alan Moore, you know, whatever, Watchmen and whatnot. I mean, again, I don't think these are shocking things, but the stuff, a lot of it does hold up. And look, there are things too that I can appreciate the fact that it may not hold up, but I still, you know, love just having a representation of it. You know, I'm trying to think, you know, as I think I mentioned, I also collect movie props. Yeah. And so I have a movie prop from the movie Tron. I've watched it recently. I still like it, but I'm also willing to say there are parts that are a little slow and there are parts that are a little boring. And, you know, if obviously if you could, you know, so it could hold up better, but I still remember the as much the excitement of this sort of computer generated movie and the parts of it that are good are still really good. The light cycles, you know, the discs and whatever. And so I have a disc from the movie, which is really just a frisbee. I mean, it's really just a frisbee with some like electrical tape on it. It's quite amazingly terrible, but it's wonderful.
Sure.
And maybe that's how I feel about the movie.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like this with that movie, especially like the thrill of it.
Yes.
Like the good parts over, you know, overshadow like the kind of boring human, the talking parts. I
mean. Well, it's not even the talking. There's some good talk. Sure. And then there's a middle. There's like a middle.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's, you know, I look back when I used to get the Scholastic book orders in school, and I used to get a lot of Garfield and Calvin and Hobbes.
Okay.
And then, so my parents like recently moved out of their home that I, you know, grew up partly in. And I looked back at a lot of they kept everything. They're insane. There's stuff I haven't thought of since I dropped it on the floor, but I kept it. Anyways, there was a lot of Garfield and a lot of Calvin Hobbes left, and Garfield, I don't think is controversial to say, does not hold up.
Sure.
And I loved it as a kid.
Right.
Maybe I was smarter as a kid, but I just didn't get any of it.
Right.
But Calvin Hobbes really holds up.
Yeah.
You know? And like, I don't know what it was about Garfield that I loved, but...
No, but I mean, everyone loved it, but you don't hear people talking about it. And by the way, that happens with everything. I mean, there are TV shows, you know, this is not neither here nor there. This is just, I guess, culture, which is to say, you know, when Seinfeld was on, there were obviously other shows that people, you know, loved at the time. You know, now here we sit and I take no credit. I didn't create Seinfeld. Sure. Obviously, Larry and Jerry did. I was just proud to work there. But now, whatever it is, you know, 25 years later or whatever, you don't hear about those shows that much. You know what I mean? And yet, you know, it would shock people somehow to kind of be told like, yeah, Seinfeld used to lose the Emmy year after year to like Frasier.
Yeah.
When was the last time anyone mentioned it? I'm not, you know, I'm just simply saying tastes change, things hold up, things don't. Nope. It's what it is. Yeah.
My girlfriend and I try to watch either Seinfeld or Cheers before at night before going to sleep.
And those two, I mean, they hold up. I went back recently when poor Harry Anderson died.
Yeah.
And I went back and I watched all the Harry the Hat episodes of Cheers, which were so goddamn
He was great.
Good. Yeah, God, he was good. Yeah,
yeah, he was. I guess, I mean, he went to Night Court, so good for him.
But yeah, but I mean, but those early appearances were so good.
Yeah, they were really awesome. And so you talk about movie props.
Yes.
Also, that is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it is definitely a whole different ballgame. And it was something I came to a little bit later, I was definitely deeper into my sort of comic art world, which was good. You know, it's sort of like I learned a lot of lessons in comic art collecting. I mean, I learned about, I think when I first started comic art collecting, I just bought whatever I saw. And I didn't think to myself, like, if this is a story I like, I'm going to buy this page, even though it's not the page I want. I really want this other page, or I want the cover, or whatever it is. But I bought it because it was in front of me, and kind of learned, wait, maybe that will show, or maybe you'll find the other piece you want. So there were those lessons. Then you just learned a lot about human nature and other collectors. You know, I have made incredible friends out of in the collecting world. And then I can't even believe I'm saying this out loud. I guess if I have enemies, they exist in the comic art world.
That.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane, but it's true.
Oh, tell me all about them.
I mean, literally, a guy, you know, one guy that I was like really friendly with, like open my house up, come in, you know, whatever, hanging out with him. And then one day sort of found out, like, basically he was sort of like a piece that we had, you know, talked a lot about. He knew I was bidding on. I'd sort of discovered accidentally he was sort of bidding against me to either try and get it from me or cost me money. Huh. And it's just like, and I was shocked. I was shocked. Right. And, you know, I remember we had sort of a mutual friend in common who sort of tried to kind of go, what's going on? What's happening? And the other party sort of kind of declared something along the lines of like, it just makes me so angry that his collection is so good. And I was just like, what planet are we on?
Yeah.
But that exists. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but that exists. And I've encountered it more than once or twice. And I don't necessarily, I love my collection. My collection is me. I'm not collecting the stuff so that you don't get it. I'm collecting it. These, you know, every, you know, 99% of the pieces have stories behind them, you know, like my, you know, appendix out story.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm trying to, I'm building the Dave Mandel collection. I'm not necessarily trying to build the comic art collection of the millennium. I don't know, I'm just trying to build me.
Right.
And so the idea that somebody was so like taken aback, I don't know, but it exists. It's real. And so, and I had it happen sort of a second time with another guy, sort of similar but different, who actually is much more aggressive and to this day bids me up. Like it's now more out in the open that we don't like each other.
That's weird.
And he just sort of, but again, same thing. A guy that I thought I was friends with until I wasn't, and you just go, this is nuts.
Are these
No,
are these terrible pirate people? Like, are they in it for the money or for the joy?
I'd like to say I think they're in it for the joy, I guess, you know, or at least initially. I mean, I guess if I was going to be a little whatever caddy, one of the guys, I'm in my opinion, doesn't buy what he wants. He buys what he thinks other people think is cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I happen to buy what I want and other people think it is cool, which is a very tough thing.
Cool.
But he definitely, I think, you know, hears that like, oh, I should like Silver Surfer. So he therefore goes out and tries to acquire a great piece of Silver Surfer art. And I would say that myself, I can appreciate Silver Surfer. I love like John Buscema, who worked on Silver Surfer. I don't own any Silver Surfer art because I didn't read it. It was not something I read as a kid.
Sure.
I can appreciate it, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I don't think he read it either, but someone has told him you should have a piece like that. And that's a big difference mm-hmm. to me. So that's my harsh criticism
right.
of one of these guys, is that they're in it for wrong reasons. I don't know if it's speculation, but it's on the border of speculation.
Yeah. I was going to say, if I was to collect comics, it would be like, and like, I do have a lot of comics, but not any like,
sure.
I don't go after back issues and stuff because I live in a box and work as a journalist. But no, it'd be like Spider-Man from the mid to late 90s. Cause that was when I was really got first into it, you know, like the Ben Reilly era and all that.
Yeah.
Like that was like, I know he's back, but like that was like my thing. So if I was to do it, it would be then, not because like this issue would be valuable.
Right. But by the way, that does mean, but some of those might be valuable.
Sure.
And you know what I mean? And that's that is unfortunately the good and the bad of this kind of collecting. But anyway, what I was saying is I definitely learned a lot of lessons in my sort of comic art collecting. Mm-hmm. And so when I did start collecting movie props for sort of similar reasons, in the sense of, you know, I had a lot of interesting movie posters. I mean, again, as much as my walls would allow me. But, you know, again, it's like I have a movie poster, you know, you have a movie poster, we all have a movie poster. Yeah. And then there were some rarer movie posters. Certainly in the Star Wars world, there were some cool cool ones like, you know, the Comic-Con by giveaway by Chaykin, the birthday, you know, the birthday cake one. It was the 1 year when Star Wars had been playing in movie theaters for a year. They did a birthday cake poster with action figures on it to celebrate Star Wars being in theaters for a year, which you can't even think about. But like, that's a rarer poster. And so like, I would put that up because, you know, it was a little more interesting than the 40 guys I knew that had a Star Wars poster. But when I bumped into my first movie prop, which was actually a Return of the Jedi Stormtrooper helmet that I bumped into in a toy magazine, basically, and bought it in auction. It was sort of like a phone auction. This sort of dates everything. Like, you know, the internet was sort of wild and woolly. So this was a classified ad in the back of this sort of newspaper magazine called Toy Shop, which came out, I don't know, weekly or bi-weekly. Mm-hmm. And basically it was a phone auction where you just had to keep calling the number and bidding. but again, that idea of like actually owning something, you know, that was on the set of one of my all-time favorite movies. I mean, just the jazz of that, but definitely my movie prop collection is definitely smaller and more focused than, say, my comic art, just because I came into it a little later. You know, prices were already starting to get aggressive and then got more aggressive. But I definitely came into it sort of more focused, having learned certain lessons. But yeah, no, I mean, so, you know, again, same thing, though. It's like the movies that spoke to me. So I have something from Tron. I have a bunch of Star Wars stuff. I definitely have a large Star Wars collection. Right. And it's not just props. I'm also into, you know, sort of art, you know, whether it's storyboards or that kind of stuff. And that's sort of how we got to the Macquarie stuff, which we can talk about later. But, you know, again, so sort of production art, pre-production art, post-production art, art for posters, for the releases, things like that. You know, definitely into all of that kind of stuff. And again, from my favorite movies. So I have something, I have a helmet from Excalibur because I love Excalibur. Mm-hmm. And I have something from one of the Harry Potter movies. I have an apes costume from the original Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
I have some stuff from Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark movies because you have to have that. Yes, exactly. I have some Wolverine claws. So again, you're seeing certain things like superheroes that kind of go through the comic art and then into the Star Wars stuff. And then occasionally I have some, you know, interesting things. I have, that like speak to me that have nothing to do with superheroes. So again, I don't have a real prop, but I have a call sheet, you know, a call sheet. I have a call sheet from Some Like It Hot, which is one of my all-time favorite comedies. I have a little sculpture that was a crew gift, almost like a gift to like the high-end people on the production. It's a bronze mold, or I guess a bronze statue of like a little clay figurine that Dick Smith, the makeup guy, made of Marlon Brando's face as Vito Corleone.
Oh my God.
So it's this little bronze that was kind of like, you know, like, I don't know how many they made, like 20 of them or something. Yeah, exactly. And it's also, I don't know if you know this, they used to sell programs for movies in the theaters. It's on the cover of the Godfather program. Yeah, like a real close-up of it. So again, that's my Godfather thing. You know what I mean?
That's
so
really cool.
Things like that just, you know, because you got to have something from the Godfather. So that, you know, again, it's sort of like, that's sort of my prop collection.
My dream would be the duck suit from Howard the Duck. I wonder
I'm sure it's
is.
Out there.
I mean, it's funny because a lot of these things get put in storage or reused, you know, so it's like kind of the same thing with the art. Like, the question is like, who owns it too?
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I mean, there's definitely stuff. I mean, you know, to this day, you definitely can find stuff with guys that worked on the movie. I mean, that's first of all, which is whether it was an actor or a crew guy that just, you know, was, and I'm not talking about like took it illegally. I'm talking about like, anybody want this? No, take it or given to them. Like, why don't you take this? Congratulations for working on it. There's an auction coming up, a Julian's auction house in like a week or two where I think he was an art director or something on Return of the Jedi is auctioning off a couple of the pieces that, you know, at the end of production, someone said, why don't you just take them, you know, and now, whatever, 80 million years later, he's selling them off. Good for him. Obviously, back in the day, there were these central kind of costume houses. So people would like in Los Angeles, movie costumes came from Western Costume. And so over the years, people, you know, Western Costume is this huge collection. And so people will find like even just in the random rack of like I don't know, you know, like Asian themed jackets. And it'll be like, wait a second. I think this was in, you know, Star Trek in 1963, right. You know, because it, the stuff just, that's where it was. And So they've sold stuff. Everybody sells stuff. Planet Hollywood used to buy stuff. So, you know, it's out there. And then of course, like anything else, and this is the problem, as things cost more money, you start getting into fakes and people trying to sell stuff that isn't quite what it was. And, you know, you, and this is, you know, something, and I don't know how much you guys talk about this on your show, but especially as I'm getting into these collectibles, or I should say I'm into these collectibles that are starting to, like, really, you know, hit some numbers that are not for, you know, mere mortals. You know what I mean? Do your research. I mean, I don't know what else to say, especially in the prop world where it's just so easy to go, here's a lightsaber. You know, I mean, I cannot tell you the number of fake lightsabers I've seen in my lifetime. Yeah, no, it sucks. And I've seen fake lightsabers, you know, you hate to say this, I've seen them with, you know, really good stories. I've seen them with letters, you know, and it's just, and it's bullshit. And it's, and, but you got to do your research. I mean, that's just really it. And these days, thank gosh, because of, like, you know, Blu-ray and 4K, it's like, freeze your screen and look for things. So I can tell you the following. I have a jacket from the third movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you 100%, I can do a screen grab of Indy and his dad when they're on the motorcycle, you know, when they're escaping the chateau and they're on the motorcycle. And I can do a screen grab and you can see Indy's jacket and you can see scratches on the leather, like three very, you know, a couple of distinct scratches. And I can show you those on my jacket. And that's
cool.
How I know that that is that jacket, as opposed to someone just saying, this is a jacket.
Right.
And then you just got to do your work. I mean, it's a lot of work, by the way. And I can't tell you the number of things that I've spent, like, you know, a year researching or tracking down only to kind of go, I don't think it's right, or there's something off. But I've also had success stories. I mean, I even once, believe it or not, hired a private eye and tracked something down.
Which, what did you track down?
You'll get a kick out of this. So this is the story. I'll tell sort of the best version I can, which is, do you remember when the original Star Wars movies came out? You were too young, but maybe you've seen them. They did, like, the glasses at Burger King?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the glasses, on the first movie, there weren't just glasses. There were posters and glasses, okay? But it's the same art. Four pieces of art. There's a droids one, like a bad guy one with, like, Darth Vader and, like, Grand Moff Tarkin on it. There's kind of a Luke one, and then there's a Han and Chewie one. So there's four posters, four glasses, okay? The posters were done by this wonderful artist, Dell. I'm sorry for not knowing the name off the top of my head. He was down in the greater sort of Atlanta area. Anyway, I was always trying to find these posters. I believe he's passed away. I checked in with his children. You know, it's all the whole
the search.
Yes, got nowhere. Deep diving on the internet, at some point or another, I found a guy who had posted a note to, like, a Star Wars group, kind of going, what do you guys think these are worth? I have these things from my father who worked at Coca-Cola back in the day. And it was them. And I guess he had tried to get a hold of George Lucas. It was a whole story. It was really interesting. It was many, many years ago. So there's this post. So I try and, like, send him an email through the post. Nothing. But there was a little bit of information. Like, I think I had, like, a first name, if memory serves, and, like, Atlanta and Coca-Cola. You know, I had these pieces. And I kept finding little couple other odds and ends of clues. And basically, it was a dead end. And oddly enough, I was at my daughter's preschool, you know, at the end of the year, sitting there chatting. And I start talking to one of the parents. And there was a girl, and one of her moms was a private eye, and I had remembered hearing her stories because I had met her when we first joined the school.
That's pretty badass.
And so, yeah, it was really cool. And I sort of said, and she used to auction off in our, like, school auction, like, come on a mission with me. You know what I mean? Like
that's,
you
a
know,
movie waiting to
no,
happen.
I know. It's just like, you know, I think she was just, you know, it's like come on a ride along or whatever it was. But anyway, so I was making conversation, and I sort of all of a sudden realized, like, hey, do you think if I had gave you some pieces of information, you could find a guy? And she's like, well, that's what I do, right. Literally. And she's like, look, I'm finishing something up. I'm busy, whatever. I was like, okay, well, I'll bug you like in a month. And about a month went by and I sent her the pieces of the information I had. And she did like a day or two of work. And I remember her contacting me and going, yeah, I'm still not finding it. And I said, look, I think I said something like, she was kind of almost like searching America. And I said, concentrate on Atlanta. I think Atlanta is where Coke was headquartered. Just, it's gotta be Atlanta. Mm-hmm. By the way, these people could have moved anywhere.
Sure.
Less than 24 hours later, she emails me and goes, here's his information. He's waiting for your call.
Oh, wow.
And I call the guy. And of course, he got a real kick out of this fact that someone had tracked him down with a private eye.
Was he freaked out at all?
No, I think he was, well, I mean, he might have been a little nervous at first, but then he kind of laughed. And by the way, it helps when the crazy person calling you also is like, hey, I was a writer on Seinfeld, yes. Curb Your Enthusiasm, and you know, now Veep. It's not like a lunatic, you know, it's not like, hey, I'm living with my parents in their basement and I'm going to murder you and make a suit out of your skin.
Very
it's
different.
Like, it's someone, you know, kind of at least semi-reputable calling. But he sort of got a kick out of it. And, you know, he had tried to sell them a million years ago, didn't want to sell them. I convinced him to sell them. And what actually worked out great was he sold them to me, which was wonderful. I ended up making like a really high quality kind of set of prints of them for a couple of my friends, yeah. And then also for him, so he would still have like a really nice version of it. But we actually got to know each other like decently, and he came to Comic-Con. I helped get him into Comic-Con and stuff. And you know, when we still email. I mean, that's literally cool. To this day, we still email and chat, and you know, he'll come to Comic-Con and stuff. And so again, like I said, you do also make some really
right.
good friends in the hobby also. But yeah, but so that's my craziest collector
story. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because you are on kind of both sides of it. You know, like people would love, comedy nerds would love stuff from Seinfeld. You know, actors and writers who were in a lot of these things. So as a collector, how does that either impact your search or the way you present it?
You know, I laugh a little bit about it in the sense of, you know, I took one or two things off the Seinfeld set, yeah. Like in the back end.
What'd you take?
I wrote from my episode, from the Bizarro Jerry right. episode, we made, you know how Jerry always had the Superman statue?
Yes.
We made a Bizarro Superman statue because one didn't right. exist at the time. So we
okay.
made one
character.
Where basically our guys took a plastic Superman statue and kind of painted it white. So it's kind of cruddy, but it's in the back of the scene.
Yeah.
And I took it and I had all of the cast sign the base. And so cool. That's a real favorite of mine.
Yeah.
What else? I took like a place setting and like a napkin holder and like coffee stuff from the coffee
yeah.
shop, you know, like odds and ends
sure.
like that, which was fun. And I've definitely taken bits and pieces from other things I've worked on, you know, like on Veep, like, you know, when we make a book up, like Selena's book, I take, you know, I take a book or a voting poster, that kind
yeah.
of things. You know, I don't, for the most part, I have not bugged like my buddies. I guess
sure.
I could have. The one buddy that I do bug is I have a very good friend of mine, named Brian Burke, who for a long time was J.J. Abrams' producing partner.
Right.
And he was always very kind enough to take pity upon me and not only invite me to like get to see the sets, so I got to visit the various like Star Trek
sure.
sets, and I actually went out to London and visited Force Awakens.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't get anything from the Force Awakens from him, but he hooked me up with some Star Trek stuff. So
security must
cool.
be insane at Force
yeah,
Awakens.
Yeah, I think Force Awakens is a whole other
yeah.
kettle of fish.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's really awesome. I was thinking about what I would want from a Seinfeld set as a huge Mets
sure.
fan. His hat hanging, the Mets hat hanging. I mean,
yeah,
like I'm sure that's been, you know, who knows. But like that to me is like, as growing up a Mets fan,
sure.
in an era when the Yankees were winning championship,
yep.
championship, like, well, Seinfeld likes the Mets,
right.
so it's okay. So like that's like, you know, it's a little meaningful things that make a difference.
I will tell you this. I know this is not necessarily a collecting story, and believe me, this is not. I'm not trying to sort of humble brag, but I'm a Yankees fan, so let me start
okay.
with that.
All right. Well,
good
thing you told me now.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I got invited by Jerry. He gave me like two tickets for the game, and I basically was with my like good child, you know, good college buddy, basically sitting at the, I don't know what his seats are like now. He had sort of two and two, and so it was me and my buddy, and in the row in front of us was Jerry and Keith Hernandez. And it was, and I will tell you, because I was not there for that episode. So believe me when I tell you, I was a Seinfeld fan before I worked at Seinfeld. Sure. I mean, for me, it was just like a revelation, not just comedy wise, but also, you know, as a New York Jew, basically. Right. And so just, I mean, again, I had known Jerry at this point for a while. We'd worked together. And even I was just sort of like fanboying out about like sitting behind these two guys and basically listening as Keith Hernandez kind of whisper called the game for Jerry.
He's so good.
Yeah. And he's so good.
He's I mean, I know you're Yankees fans. You probably don't watch many Mets games.
I don't watch a lot of Met games, but I read a couple of years ago, I read his first book. I don't know if you've ever read
1985.
No, I guess maybe it's his middle book. It's not his sort of biography. It's the book where basically he took two games, a National League game and an American League game. The American League game is a Yankees-Detroit game, and the National League game, I don't remember what it was. And he goes through it, and basically you read pitch by pitch every adjustment and strategic thing. And it's brilliant. And he's a neat guy.
He wrote a book chronicling the 1985 season. It was like a day-by-day journal. I think this was like during the whole like cocaine hearing too.
Sure.
I think that was happening. And I read it, I must have been like 12 or something.
Right.
And like, this was years after he published it. But like that cemented my like love of Keith Hernandez. And then when I interned for the Mets in college.
Oh, fun.
You know, it was like 2006, which was a great year up until that last curveball.
Right.
And he was in the cafeteria and I was there because I was getting food before the game. I mean, I was like, you know, starstruck all the time because I was working.
Right.
You
know, for the Mets.
But, but him, because I had worked as a bat boy and a clubhouse manager for a minor league team, like in high school. So like I was kind of used to the whole baseball player thing. A lot of John Rocker was on the team in the league. So, but like seeing him, I like couldn't talk to him. And I interview people all the time, like on red carpets or wherever people people who I really admire, but I just couldn't talk to Keith Hernandez.
That's hilarious.
Because I was like the idea of him thinking I was a dipshit, which was like probably 80%. Like I just couldn't let that be the case. But yeah, like that must have been really cool to see them.
No, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, look, when I think back on like other stuff from Seinfeld, I got a big softball. And so on the final episode, when all that guest cast came back, I had people sign this giant softball. I mean, it's barely readable, but I did it for me, you know, I just did it cause it was fun and I wanted to remember, you know, being there, you know, in that moment. So yeah.
So things like, so with the new Star Wars movies, you're like, I mean, you're a huge Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
You went to the Force Awakens set. So as someone who's in Hollywood and winning Emmys and like, you know, Star Wars is happening on the same level, like you said, you went to the set. Or do you ever think about trying to get involved in comic book movies or Star Wars?
You know, it's funny. I mean, for those of you listening that, you know, I would love to. Yeah. I mean, it's that funny thing of like, I guess of late, I guess a lot of the superhero movies are starting to get funnier. So maybe there's hope. You get put in your box. I mean, you just do. And I'm in a very nice box, but it's a very specific box.
Sure.
I like my box, but it's hard to get out of your box.
Right.
And it just, you know, it's one of those things of like, I'm sure a lot of the people would be the first to say, oh, we love Veep and oh, yeah, whatever, whatever. But I'm not necessarily anybody's first thought but yeah, it'd be really fun.
I mean, Deadpool is funny. Like,
no, absolutely.
Ragnarok
and
was
again,
hilarious.
I'm not. Yeah, Ragnarok. Yeah, absolutely. So again, they're, you know, and the Guardians movies too.
Yes, true. Yep.
So, but it just, I mean, I don't know. This sounds like such a strange thing to say. Those are movies being written by movie writers who are also funny, but they're not necessarily being written by what I would call comedy writers per se.
I get it.
In the sense of they're not. They're just not looking for comedy.
Sure.
I don't know. It is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And then, obviously with Solo, it was the whole ordeal when they had comedy guys.
Yes, exactly. So maybe perhaps no comedy guys will ever be hired again. I don't quite know. visited that set too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Before.
Oh,
I
boy.
Visited the sort of, I guess it would have been, I was there for spring break. So I was there like in April. So before the June where they were sort of let go.
Was it seem like things were chill then?
Seemed more than chill. And in fact, you know, they showed me at the time, I mean, I guess now no one's going to get in trouble. They showed me some cut together stuff that, you know, I don't know. I mean, we'll never quite know the percentages, but some of what I saw definitely seemed like it was in the movie unless they so reshot it similarly.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah.
But no, it seemed, I mean, to the naked eye, I mean, I've been on a lot of sets. Yeah. I didn't get any sense of anything at the time going wrong,
right.
But clearly whatever. Yeah.
What would be like a dream superhero movie for you to do if you could, like, if you had a general meeting with Marvel or Warner Brothers?
I mean, you mean, You mean something they haven't done or something?
You could reboot it or something they haven't done.
I mean, you know, in the Marvel world, I guess character wise, I'm a sucker for Spider-Man. Sure. I'm a sucker for the X-Men. And what I love about, one of the things I truly love about Spider-Man is really, especially if you go back to the early, like Stan Lee, Steve Ditko mm-hmm. stuff, and it changed a bit in the way sort of like the suit itself allowed him to become this other person, that the sort of the sort of, unlike in Superman's world where Clark Kent is sort of a fakeness, Peter Parker was very much who he was, a very nerdy, you know, sort of, I don't know, troubled, lonely yeah. kid. And the suit gives him a confidence to sort of speak and, you know, quip in a different way. And I always loved that sort of idea. Yeah. I think Spider-Man would be really fun.
Yeah, I mean, that was always my favorite yeah. growing up. When you're like the wimpy kid who's yeah. sometimes funny, you're like,
yeah.
Like, of course you want
right.
to do that.
No, exactly. It's like, yes, he's got superpowers, but also he takes it as an opportunity to sort of crack wide.
Yeah. yeah. Have you enjoyed the new Star Wars movies like Last Jedi and Solo?
Oh, you know, I've found in my life, and I'll just simply say it this way, and of course then everyone can read into it whatever you want. You know, just I guess because I'm in the entertainment industry right. and I make something. Look, everyone's, you know, welcome to their opinion, obviously. I've liked them. My kids really like them, mm-hmm. which makes me very happy. They're hit and miss for me, you know, but I don't like getting into it too much.
Sure,
you
yeah.
know, it just, no one needs my criticism.
Well, what's yeah. interesting is like people who grew up loving these things, you know, are so, you know, not always,
right.
but often very, there's an ownership there. And I think that's happened a lot with Star Wars, you know.
I have not found the need to threaten to rape Rose Tico.
Yeah.
Let me put it that
yeah, yeah.
way. I've so far not, yeah. don't need to do that.
Yes.
I guess people that take so, I mean, I love Star Wars. I love Star Wars as much as anybody. But if you can't separate your love of Star Wars from basic human decency,
right.
go F yourself. I mean, yeah. I don't know what else to say. And even if you love it that much, and forget about, obviously, those attacks, which were just horrific on her, all the verbal stuff and the internet stuff. But if you just somehow can't enjoy it because it's not the same, well, then, I don't know. You know, it's like, I'd like to think when the ones I've liked because I think they're good movies. And when I don't like them, it's not because they're not Star Wars to me. I just, you know, I guess maybe I didn't think it was as interesting, but right. not in a, you can't do that. I realize I'm sort of, it's very, all very vague.
Right.
But you know
no,
what
I get
I mean?
What you mean?
Yeah.
Well, especially as a guy who makes,
I'm not
yeah.
so attached that the possibility of them being, you know, existing on their own is right. gone for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, what's kind of nice to me is like there's so many of them now in a way that like, I think they're special and I enjoy them, but like they don't feel like a holy like text being handed down now
right.
in a way, which is like kind of nice. Take the mystique away and you can just enjoy
and
it.
And by the way, maybe, you know, and again, it's such a different time. I'm not sure, you know, this is one of those tough things. If the original Star Wars came out today, it wouldn't be the original Star Wars. And what I mean by that is when I talked to you before about like a movie staying in a theater for a year, when a movie stayed in a theater for a year, it allowed people like me to go see it. You know, you would have contests mm-hmm. with your friends. Like I've seen it 23 times. I've paid 23 times to see the movie, you know, crazy stuff like that, that, you know, kids would do. Like, you know, I remember going to like friends' birthdays a year in and like, we're going to go see Star Wars again for the birthday, even though we saw it together already. And so, no movie is ever going to be like that if it comes out today.
Sure.
Whether it's a Star Wars sequel, something new, whatever. It's just, I think we consume things so very differently. And I'm thrilled that I got to see it. I mean, I'll tell you this, for my kids, you know, talking about collecting, I went out and I've acquired an original print of the non-special edition Star Wars, a 70 millimeter mm-hmm. print of Star Wars, and I have a Return of the Jedi, and I have a buddy that has Empire. And when my daughter hits 7 years old, a bunch of my friends and I, we rented a theater and we showed the cool. movie on the big screen, non-special edition, to the kids in our lives so that they would at least have that as sort of like a sense memory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's some collecting for you.
Did they love it?
They loved it. They yeah. loved it. And, you know, and again, you know, you try not to, I don't want to be, you know, it's like, I don't want to be the sports dad of Star Wars. You know what I mean? Where
right.
it's just like, I'm going to shove Star Wars down your throat so you, you know, until you hate it and hate
right.
me. You know, I show them these things and I want them to like them, you know, onto themselves. Like my son right now cannot get enough Marvel. Like, cannot get enough Marvel. Like, the Marvel movies, he'd seen a couple of them. We'd seen a couple of them. And then Infinity War blew his little mind. And don't get me wrong, I liked it too. Right. But it blew his little mind. And he just started, like, literally was like some days waking himself up at like 5 a.m. because he wanted to watch an hour of Iron Man before school. You know, and now I'm sort of trying to see if he'll read some comics too. Right. And, you know, but again, trying not to push. And now he's just telling me how much he hates DC. And I'm laughing because, of course, I always read Marvel and DC. But so, you know, you take it where you can get it. But right now for him, it's Marvel, Marvel, Marvel. Sure. He doesn't dislike Star Wars, but he has no time for Star Wars right now. It's Marvel.
That's not a bad problem to have.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are your dream pieces that you're still going after to make your more perfect collection?
There's probably things in each category, if that makes any sense. I will say in the sort of movie prop world, my true dream piece, I guess, would probably be a Star Wars piece. And I can say, and I don't know what it would be. I could definitely say some that would be better than others. Mm-hmm. But I would love to own, if it was ever possible, an honest to God, original, you know, screen built ILM miniature. You know, like, and one of the earlier ones where, you know, like, because later on, for example, like in the first movie, they had to build all the X-Wings. But later on the later movies, like in Jedi, they could actually buy Star Wars model kits of X-Wings and then they would hand paint them.
Huh.
Don't get me wrong. It's still cool.
That's pretty cool. It's funny.
But you know what I'm saying? But the scratch built, the ones that they put together, if I could have a, you know, a recognizable ship, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
So that's probably, it's probably up there in my sort of dream prop world. Mm-hmm. In the comic art world, you know, I'm sure there's a couple of things I could think of, but certainly, like, for example, there's a piece, I know where it is. It's in the collection of the Inker. Do you know the, again, I don't know how much X-Men you ever read, but probably the definitive X-Men story of my life was Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
And the cover of X-Men 141, which is old Wolverine and older Kitty Pryde in front of all the wanted signs indicating that many of the X-Men are deceased. That cover exists. It's in the Inker, Terry Austin. It was penciled by John Byrne, inked by Terry Austin. Terry Austin owns it. He has no intention of selling it anytime soon, but that would be a dream. You know, we were talking Star Wars earlier. Star Wars 7, which was the first standalone Han Solo Chewbacca adventure. I have the 9 now, but the 7 would really mean a lot to me. Mm-hmm. So some things.
And so do you like peruse auction houses? Or
Yeah. I mean, it's that funny mix of, I'm definitely at that point in my life and career where I grab every catalog with gusto. And then sometimes when I get through it all and there's nothing I want, I'm like, okay, that was good. Good. You know what I mean? Like I live to fight another day. Yeah.
You know, I was curious, you started doing this in like a while, like over 2 decades ago. Were you with your wife at the time?
My wife and I, which is a whole other podcast. We were very much pre-marriage. We got married. We didn't get married actually till the end of 2006, but we've actually known each other and sort of been on and off since college.
Okay.
So I believe when I truly first started collecting, we were sort of, I guess, off and then soon on again, but we were not. She wasn't living in the same, she was living in a different city. So we were not like regularly together.
And so what does she make of all the collections?
She's actually pretty good about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, she definitely, you know, the comic art, maybe a little less so. I mean, she appreciates it, but didn't ever really read any of the comics. I think she's read Watchmen, maybe Dark Knight Returns, but you know, the individual covers and why she likes my stories. Like she likes hearing why it's important to
makes
me,
sense.
But not necessarily what it is. Like she could walk by it, not know or care. She definitely loves the movies and she likes the movie props and thinks it's neat. And definitely my kids now who are 10 and 8 are definitely into the movie props too right now. Some of the art, but definitely the movie props. And so, you know, that's sort of been fun too. If I get a new piece, they all, you know, I'll either bring it to the house or they come over to see it. And that's been fun. So she's about as understanding as you can be considering what nonsense it all is. Yeah.
You know, something just, and I don't want to take too much more of your time, but something just flashed on the TV. They're sending Paul Manafort to jail.
Oh.
When you're, I don't like change the subject completely,
yeah, please.
But like writing Veep, like when you're watching all this stuff happening, does it affect the way you write it?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, the honest answer is the following. You know, we were all set to go last fall, obviously, when Julia was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I should preface everything with she's, you know, recovery, thank great, God. Everything all good. And we're about to start kind of going again. We're about to, the writers, I think, come back to the office after the 4th of July, and we'll start shooting hopefully in mid-August. I shouldn't say hopefully, we'll start shooting. We are going to start shooting in mid-August. We had worked on about 5 scripts. We had mapped out the season last summer and then worked on about 5 scripts. And obviously, Trump was president. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I don't know how else to put it. You know, sort of after we sort of shut down, especially this, like, sort of from the moment we almost seemed to, like, pass the 1-year mark of his presidency, where like the crazy seemed to get ramped up a little bit. I've definitely had to rethink the season. I've definitely thrown stuff in the garbage, rejiggered things, glued things together. Just in terms of trying to, I guess, number one, obviously things happen and you don't want to do, you want to try and get close, but not too close, but you want to recognize it, but also just, what are we saying on the show? Yeah. I know that sounds like a silly thing to say, but like, what is politics about right now? And that feels very strange right now. And so, yeah, it's been hard. I will not lie. Obviously, I'm thrilled that we're going to do this season, but I am not unhappy that this is going to be the final season.
Yeah. I love the show, first of all. So, but if you look at, there are, someone tweeted actually yesterday saying, if you were to like say, children are being thrown in prisons that used to be Walmarts by President Donald Trump. Like in 95, you would have been like, that plot would have been like, you would have laughed at a literary world or
something. Yeah, no, absolutely. But I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, I didn't, obviously, the Veep was created by Armando Iannucci. And when he created it, part of the idea was sort of showing, you know, a peek behind the curtain. This is what politics are really like. This is what politicians are really like. You know, this is what they're like in their privacy. None of that seems true anymore. There's no sense of that. We know exactly what he's like. There's no private. Yeah. It just is. And so much of the humor was always like, this is the worst person that should ever be president. Well, I think we've proven that's not true.
Selena Myers would be on Mount Rushmore now.
This is the stupidest staff you've ever seen. Not true either. So much of, like, I guess if you were making Veep today from scratch, you know, as opposed to season 7, I don't quite know what you would be saying it was. And so that's sort of some of the problem we're dealing with in season 7.
And the thing about Veep is, like, these people are kind of terrible, but you learn to love them and you root for them and whatever.
Sure.
Like, there is nothing good about anybody in the world. I mean, running the world right now.
No. I mean, watching them yesterday, and look, these are my opinions. You know, I pride myself on the show where, and I say this to you even with this, the coming season of season 7, none of this is ever going to be in the show, in the sense of the show will continue to be that sort of walk, that sort of middle line where we're never going to say a party. We're going to pick issues from both sides. We're going to make fun of everybody. There's no agenda there. The show will continue to remain sort of party free and neutral.
I mean, Selena's an awful person. And she's Democrat.
Exactly.
So.
Well, no, she's not Democrat. We've never said that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, we've never say that. Democrat. We never say Republican. And one of the funny things about the show is Republicans watch the show and think she's a Democrat, and Democrats watch the show and think she's a Republican.
Maybe it's just
really
that
funny.
The guy she ran against was seemed like a Republican.
He seemed
to me.
Sort of, and by the way, there were moments where, like, yes, guy from Texas seems Republican. Yeah. And by the way, woman seems Democrat. But again, technically speaking, we never say any of this stuff. So the show is very neutral. David Mandel, citizen of Earth, I am very unneutral. I mean, this is watching. I mean, I honestly don't know what's worse. He's a monster. Watching the people that work for him justify his actions with the Bible and whatnot is disgusting. Watching the lies on a daily basis, watching Trump and then Sarah Huckabee Sanders say that basically somehow that, like, they don't want to be pulling children away from their family, but that's what the Democrats want. I mean, and that's what the law says. Yeah. I mean, this is crazy shit. I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse.
Please do.
It's just crazy shit. And then watching the rest of the Republican Party run and hide and sort of no comment. And that's the part I'll never truly understand.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, their head should be on sort of pikes on the bridge. But anyway, that's Dave Mandel, not Veep.
I hope there's like a Nuremberg at some point.
I would really be nice.
Yeah, like a Paul Ron saying, well, you know, I haven't started the issue enough. But I just can't imagine trying to top it, because writing a script that looks like this was going on today.
Yes, no, it's been really hard. I mean, that's the honest answer. Yeah. It's been really hard. I mean, I'm glad we're ending. I think we're going to go out with a real bang, but I'm happy it's ending. It's become... it's like diving. The levels of difficulty have really increased. Yes. Like, it's like all of a sudden we had to add like a fourth flip to make it something else.
When you are done with the show, are you going to like zone out of politics a little bit? Because it just,
I'd like to definitely ratchet it a little bit down. Like, there are definitely days where like, I'm almost like make myself crazy if I haven't gotten to all the sort of newsletters and things that I subscribe to that are in my inbox, like they haunt me a little bit. I definitely like to ratchet it down, but at the same time, I feel like, as again, back to me, the person, if you're not involved, you're part of the problem. Obviously the other day, or was it yesterday? I lose track of the days. You know, yesterday, New York State basically said they're filing suit about
charity.
The Trump Foundation. And obviously that's wonderful and bravo. But, you know, one could make the point that had they been on this guy and this fake foundation, which existed for many years, if these charges had been filed, let's say, 5 years ago, he wouldn't be president of the United States. So it's hard to get too excited that they're kind of getting to it now, where either, maybe there'll be a fee or something, but he's not going to not be president because of this foundation. Right. He could have maybe not been president because of the foundation nonsense. And he's a crook. He is an honest to God crook. But, a lot of my sort of Democrat friends, oh, bravo. And it's like, too little too late.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I run this newsletter and like raising money for like progressive candidates across the country. And I mean, we had a great week this week. It's up to like, we've raised like 40K or something, which is, I mean, nothing compared to what the Koch brothers have. But like, I'll go home and really want to play Zelda, but I'm like, I gotta learn about, oh my God, Michigan is going to put work requirements on Medicaid. I need to now study this issue. And again, very nice problem to have. I have health insurance, so, I can give up Zelda for a night, to help, to do what minor thing I can do to help. But yeah, it's really hard to zone, unplug when everything seems so bad.
It just keeps hitting you over the head. And again, it doesn't sound like it, but because you said a small studio, so it doesn't sound like you guys have children yet. You have a girlfriend still yet, but possibly one day and all those good things. I don't know. I just having two, having brought two lives into this world. I mean, I don't know. It's like, I mean, it's bad enough that I'm sort of feel like, well, enjoy New York while you can. It's going to be underwater by the time your kids are 40. Right. I don't know what kind of world am I handing them. It's pretty shitty.
Yeah, enjoy the Marvel comic books while you can.
Yes, exactly. By the way, soon perhaps paper will be a very valuable thing here in like the post-apocalyptic water world that we're going to be living in.
Yeah. That, you're going to have to really put a bunch of armed guards in your apartment with all that stuff. Well, listen, I will let you get to your friends and family. Thank you so much for taking
time. Oh, my pleasure.
To do this.
I hope
so
somewhere
cool.
in between all the politics and stuff, there was enough collecting talk
for the
hardcore people.
Oh,
okay,
no, this
good.
Is great. I'm... Are you going to be at Comic-Con this year?
I'm hope to be. We're, I think as I mentioned, we're starting right before it and we're shooting after it. Usually I manage to sort of schedule my life so I can kind of like, hopefully I can, what I can do is kind of give my writers just enough work where I go down Wednesday and they start sending me stuff. So hopefully. Yeah.
Well, what are you going to be looking for there?
It's funny. A lot of times these days, again, because of the way things are, with the auctions and stuff, there's not always like, you don't necessarily come in into the show and see a piece like that hits you over the head. Like, I got to buy it. It does happen once in a while. And obviously when that happens, it's wonderful. But what I find is it's still just an amazing gathering of other comic art collectors, some of whom I don't get to see that often, or maybe have only like an internet relationship with most of the year. And so, a lot of times some of them have something in their collection. And I find that Comic-Con is a great place to sort of start the possibility of a deal or culminate a deal that you've sort of been talking about. So, the sort of the gathering aspect is a pretty big to do. And then I'll be with my kids, so we'll definitely be looking for, fun new toys and
Marvel
stuff like that.
For
I think my son has his heart set right now on next school year, he wants a Captain America, like a shield backpack, like a shield for his back that is a backpack. So I believe if anyone has one of those at San Diego Comic Con, you will see us buying that.
And you can fill that with toys.
That's really fun. I mean, I love that fact that he's into it, but also just that we're going to do that.
Yeah, it's a great bonding thing. Yeah. I wish I could carry a shield backpack to work.
Well, you know, you might be able to pull it off.
I feel maybe here at Sci-Fi is the one place where I could pull that off.
If not here, why are you working
here? Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I know you're very active on Twitter, so when we sign off, we like to tell people how to get in touch on
Twitter. Oh, yeah, please. I'm on all the things, but on Instagram and on Twitter, and please follow me. I'm at David H. Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L, and... you know, there's a lot of political stuff, but also there's collectible stuff. You know, I'll post random things from my collection. A lot lately, I've been posting, I'm fascinated by like weird bootlegs, like
Star Wars from Poland?
Yeah, like Star Wars, but not even just Star Wars from Poland. I mean, even like things like space figures that have nothing to do with Star Wars, but they made Star Wars packaging. So it'll just be like a guy like in a 1950s helmet with a ray gun, but they'll be on the package. There's a Millennium Falcon.
There's a whole Twitter account for that. I'll send it to you.
Oh, please do. Yeah. So I'll post stuff from my collection, like some of that kind of stuff, but also some other things, props and art from my collection. And then a lot of especially once we get back going with Veep, when we start shooting, I try and put up one or two like behind the scene photos a day if I can, and you know, tell little production stories and whatnot. And I kind of keep doing that throughout the season. I usually live tweet the episodes, you know, different stuff like that. Try and give people a little real peek behind the show about a peek behind the curtain.
That's really awesome. Well, you can follow me at Jordan Zachern. I'll just spell it out. I always do this. I feel like if you listen this far, you probably know, but JORDANZAKARAN. And the Phantom Files, Twitter is at Phantom Files Sci-Fi. David, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, real pleasure.
So
thanks for having me. So
thank
fun.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.